Okay, so we're looking at image, does anyone know the number of it?
It's on page 245, I believe.
245.
It's discussed on page 245, is that right?
HIV.
Okay, so that is image OBC recto. With the line.
243.
Sorry, 243.
Yeah. Yeah, OBV recto.
Okay.
Or OB5.
Yeah, OB5 recto. Recto means front, I believe, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. There are two columns, one on the left, one on the right, in the upper hand. And on the right, we have Aquarius, which is Jung's ascendant. And the ascendant, astrologically, might be said to be equivalent to your persona, the face you exhibit to the world. And in the columns, in the columns is a sign for Saturn, which has Saturn and Aquarius ascending. And the circle above Saturn could be Capella. That's the only thing I could find, which is the old alchemical symbol for Capella, is that circle. And in the left-hand column, we have Leo, his sun sign, descending, it appears, and because the sun is above Leo there, and above that there's a D, but I do not know what the D might indicate, but if Aquarius is your ascending, it says, no matter what the challenge, they go forth with a spirit of adventure, but they might forsake human connections for ideas.
Certainly was his danger.
I guess so. And so Saturn in Aquarius, and he has Aquarius ascending with Saturn in Aquarius. It says Aquarius, Saturn is actually the home sign for Aquarius. And Aquarius wants to run the whole show. It wants both freedom and order all in the same package. And according to this book, Saturn can manifest quite well in Aquarius, although in our text he says it's, what does he call it, a malignant star or the star of, how does he put that? Mm-hmm. But Aquarius needs to be allowed to keep its stance of detached observation, it says. And if you have Saturn in the first house, you tend to be self-disciplined, organized, and persistent, successful, serious, and hardworking. You may have been faced with limitations as a child. And you're ready to accept major responsibilities, but on the flip side, you could also feel overly burdened by them. So those are just a few little things that I have.
Right.
We have this chart here, but I don't know. I looked online at some of the interpretations of his chart and
didn't click.
Well, I don't know. They didn't see anything very important or. Or, I don't know.
Did you see Alice's interpretation of this chart?
No, I haven't.
Have you come across that?
Do you have it?
No, I will ask her for it. Because I know she's done it.
I talked to her about it, but she was busy at the time.
So, and you just recently did?
Yeah.
Oh, so she didn't have it to send to you?
Not that I was aware of.
Okay.
I don't know, maybe I should ask her that. But also, well, Saturn, symbolically Saturn also stands for the wise old man on the one hand and death and the cruel judge on the other. So that is what I found.
Thank you. I think above all, it's, you see, this is, let's go back. This is, let me just review what we've done and then we'll come to this picture, because I think what you've said is very helpful. Just a quick review of what we did last time. We did the transformation of the God through darkness and the two sides of Siegfried. Siegfried as, in a way, the beauty of the Germans, and on the other hand, as the hero that has to be killed. We got into the conception of God. I think the big thing there was on 243, that the spirit of the dead receives his sprout. And I mean, that's almost too hard to grasp. You can get it intellectually, but I think the idea was the effect of individual work on the collective unconscious. Certainly, the effect of our work on our own unconscious. But I think what he was dealing with was the effect of individual work on the collective unconscious. And it might... it might... I was trying to put this in just ordinary language. But you might say, well, look at us. We're here today. Because he started something. And that might be a way to say how one person's work can kind of ripple out and affect the times. And who knows, you know, will any politicians ever read his work and make different decisions? That might be a way of putting the effect of the individual on the collective unconscious. And I like it because it's not something we think of very often. We think, well, we're just getting our own lives together, which is hopefully true. But I think if you work at depth, you never know in the next generation or even in your own generation what effect that work's going to have. Then... then where this picture comes up is where we started to wind down, that those who will dirty their hands and cheat on their best knowledge against error and take their virtues from a murderer's grave are invited to your great banquet. That's where this picture...
Do you think cheating on your best knowledge has to do with overcoming the superior function and allowing
yes.
the inferior function to
I do.
Have its say?
Yeah. These are, as you know, dangerous words. But the closest I can come to it that we've done before, some of you, in doing Nietzsche's Pale Criminal, that often a creative act is experienced by the collective as a crime, if not a crime defined by the legal code, but as a betrayal of what it's about, and sometimes as a betrayal of the legal code. The extreme example I always give is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. You know, he and Klaus von Stauffenberg, remember the movie Valkyrie? which apparently was accurate historically, I've been told by people who knew. Valkyrie. With Tom Cruise. See, a friend of mine is friends with von Stauffenberg's son, who lives in Zurich, and he said it was an accurate movie. So just, you know, maybe excluding Tom Cruise, I don't know. But just to give you an idea, that was not that far off what they were up to. And you know, as far as the Nazis were concerned, they were criminals, and they were executed for doing the right thing in terms of humanity. Now, that's a very extreme example, but I think this idea that often to be creative means to betray or to be experienced as betraying collective values. Later, even you know, in your generation, or often you know, in later generations, what you've done is seen as a gift. But I think many people collapse under that weight, that you've done the right thing, you've done the good thing, and at best you're neglected, or at worst you're labeled a kook, or irresponsible, or antisocial, or I mean, look what academia has done to Jung. You know, just tarred and feather him because he doesn't respect their little boxes. Now, that's the context of this picture. So, you know, I don't know what to make of it exactly. I could fantasize that maybe what Jung was saying was, well, this is my astrological fate. This is what I'm up against because this is who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's no point in discussing is it right or wrong. It's what I have to do. That's one way to look at it.
Gary, what are the words in German for ascendant and descendant? Because I was wondering about that D and the O.
Let's see.
Would that be uber? That would be over.
I think ubergehen and Niedergehen, but I'm not sure that Jung could be writing in an older German.
I was just trying to figure that O and that D out a little bit.
Over, no, it doesn't.
No, that wouldn't work.
I even wonder if their O's and D's are their shapes.
Well, they're letters. They appear when you look at them.
Yeah, but I mean, that could be a shape as well.
Is that a square in the middle of the O? Can you tell?
No.
No.
Okay. When you look at it in the high res, it's definitely just an O.
Just an O.
Okay. Because I was thinking in a Chinese coin, a square in the middle.
Mm-hmm. Which would have been reaching.
I know we discussed Saturn being the judge and the wise old man. I also see Saturn as rolling into depression.
Yeah. Yep. Wisdom comes out of depression. Some of you heard me say, Von Franz mentioned that she never trusted what she wrote when she wasn't depressed.
Thomas More talks about that a lot in The Care of the Soul. He says we should all have a Catalan garden as a way to honor the musical man.
It's such a taboo.
And there's a garden underneath.
Maybe that's exactly what he was talking about. Well, that's that takes us to the end of the first column on 243, which is where we stopped. Yeah, we don't. That's the bottom of that.
Did I do that?
No, that's something else. That's coming up. Yeah, sure, you can turn it back on.
Is that too much?
Yeah, it's too fast. Too fast to glide, it's okay. Hold the jump.
Now, some of this will be not too hard. Some of it is murder. So get ready.
Mm-hmm.
I warned you. When my prince had fallen, 243. That's the hero. So as long as we have to be the hero, we don't get the spirit of the depths. The depths opened and let me become aware of the birth of the new God. So it's to the transformation of the God image. You know, I think it's easier to say away from what than to what, but certainly away from power, vertical, structures. You know, I'm top dog, you're bottom dog kind of thing. Away from causality. Maybe towards relationship, eros, synchronicity. So on. The violent child approached me out of the terrible ambiguity. The hateful, beautiful, good, evil, laughable, serious, the sick, healthy, the inhuman, human, and the ungodly, godly. So I think we could say another characteristic of the new God image is that it contains opposites. It's not about being good. It's about the polarity, good, evil, and so on. And there, now this, he just sort of repeats himself, I think. He's giving the same theme. It was not, the God was not to be found in absolute beauty. The next paragraph, I understand that the new God would be in the relative. If the God is absolute beauty and goodness, how should he encompass the fullness of life, which is beautiful and hateful, good and evil, laughable and serious? How can man live in the womb of the God if the Godhead himself attends only to one half of him? So, realizing life's a mixture of good and evil.
Okay, so my kids were sitting at the dinner table talking about evil.
Your theologian?
Yes. And Sadie said to her sister, I wrote this down for all of you because I am still puzzling it out, but she said, there is no devil, there is no hell. Evil is just the dark side of God. And I said, are you sure God has a dark side? And she said, Mom, all you have to do is look at the flood to know that God has a dark side.
Yeah.
I said, okay, so how do you know which side of God you're getting when you pray? And she said, if you think you're getting the dark side, you get the dark side. If you think you're getting the good side, you get the good side. And I said, so what happens to bad people when they die? And she said, they go to the dark side of heaven, and they never get to come to the good side. She said, God doesn't really care if you make it to the good side or the bad side. It's just that you never get to know good. And she said that God doesn't give you as many chances as people think he does.
No.
She said, you either go with the good and try to live that, or you don't. And God does not care where in heaven you end up, except that on the dark side, he ignores you, and on the good side, he does not.
Wow.
So, and I was reading this, and I'm like, wow, did she read something? I said, have you heard me talking about this class? And she said, no, Mommy, it's just common sense. So, okay, it's not to me.
I think we have a budding theologian here. The next half, the bottom quadrant of 243, the lower half of the second column. He's just now, I think, working this idea through. That actually, it's not quite as anti... Christian as it might sound, because of the descent of Christ into hell for 3 days. I think that's pretty much 243. Not basically the new king and the fact that we're going to develop a new value system based on the polarity of good and evil, you might say.
I must have missed something big in religion. I never had heard that this Christ is coming into hell.
Well, is it biblical?
It's
part of the Apostles' Creed. Yeah.
They don't say it that way. They don't say it that way anymore.
Don't they?
I was raised on.
That's why I was raised.
On the third day, he was raised again.
Mm-hmm.
Is it to the right hand of the Father?
Yeah. Is it biblical or is it just a creed? No place in the Bible that says that.
Not that I'm aware of, but I'm sure there's got to be some underworld references.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know anything about
that. I was just looking at that one, and I didn't write it down. I can find out where...
Ask your daughter.
I don't really want to know what she thinks about it.
Could be.
They don't talk a lot about that. Do we do that? I mean,
it was big. We were discussing it was more Catholic than Protestant.
Well, we said it in the Methodist Church.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, what was supposed to happen then?
And on the third day, we're again, according to the scriptures, it says, so it must be in
I don't know, what did he do down there?
Well, God turned his back on him when he was on the cross. He had to go and atone for his sins by going to hell.
Is that
and
what it was?
He was risen again, and that's how the gates of hell were opened, so that we would be able to go to hell.
Which means hell doesn't exist anymore.
Right?
If the gate
hell doesn't exist anymore.
If he tore the gates open, then hell doesn't exist, so...
It doesn't unless you don't believe what the church told you. That's the way I understood it as a child. But that makes sense to me now.
Or, too, if that is talking about the resurrection at the end of time or something, I don't know.
It says here, no one knows what happened during the 3 days Christ was in hell. It says that, therefore, after his death, Christ had to journey to hell, otherwise the ascent to heaven would have become impossible for him. Christ first had to become his Antichrist, his underworldly brother. Mm-hmm. No one knows what happened.
Well, yeah, that's Jung's interpretation, I think. But still, it's a valid point.
Mm-hmm.
So the Bible says he does say that he descends, but Jung tacks on that it's because he had to join with his brother, the Antichrist?
Well, I don't know whether the Bible says it. Tradition says it.
Oh.
And then, yes, Jung tacks that on.
Okay.
Men of yore said that he had preached there to the deceased. How else could Christ have saved his Antichrist?
But there again, I think that's this whole Antichrist thing, that's Jung.
Mm-hmm.
But to stress the opposites, which are really contained in the story, but not recognized as such by the tradition. I think that's what he's getting at.
Wouldn't the Antichrist just be Christ's shadow?
Yeah.
So he had to go to hell to learn to love his shadow.
You could say that. I think Jung would not disagree with that, yeah. Or that Antichrist and Christ are two polarities of the Savior. That the Savior is really two poles. So whether it's the shadow of Christ or whether they're both, existing realities. I think the latter might be more like it.
You know, that's the classic mythology. The gods rule the underworld, they rule hell, and they rule heaven. And there's no distinction made between this being, you know, evil or whatever. That's very much a Christian idea that one becomes evil. But it is their polarity, their hell and the opposite. So from a classic mythological point of view, that wouldn't be an odd thing at all.
Right.
That he would descend into the underworld.
Right. And he's saying, and we've missed that in our tradition.
To send into the underworld to meet himself. And that would be a part of being recognized.
To meet his underworld self.
Right, which we all who've been there know that's
about. I wonder if that's what he means by, and again, that's wrong, but read the unknown books of the ancients and you will learn about that.
So how does this differ from Yahweh?
Well, I think Yahweh didn't know he had two sons.
Okay.
And this is becoming aware of the two sons.
Mm. Good. So it's just like us becoming our consciousness, you know, unconscious.
Right.
And then in the next paragraph he talks about what lay bound and yearning. So there... that unknown part of ourselves that wants to be known would be like the Antichrist, correct? And that's the next paragraph.
Mm-hmm. And the whole saving role of evil.
Mm-hmm.
It's a horrible thought. I told you that dream I had in divinity school about the devil saving me.
Yes.
I was climbing a ladder. Up, 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 all that intellectual crap I was being fascinated by, plus all the sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Up, 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 and I took a step, and the ladder had ended, and I started to fall. Oh, God, this is it. And I was falling, and boom, somebody caught me and put me down. I turned around, it was Satan. I said, thank you. He said, welcome. He went one way, I went another. But I think that whole debauchery part of my life was to save me from that intellectual ascent.
So what did Satan look like?
Just like in the pictures, you know. Classic. Horns, hoofs, you know, cloven hoofs. And
I thought maybe it was Ronald Reagan or something.
No. It would have been Richard Nixon.
Oh, okay.
Time.
Had
a pitchfork, everything.
Mm. What color was it?
Red and black.
Red and black.
Yeah, it was just classic Satan. Mm.
But I like to be reading through this that Jung doesn't say that hell is bad.
Right.
It's uncomfortable. It's pretty miserable.
Yeah.
But it's almost like you haven't had a full life experience if you don't spend time in hell. And you know, it's a very interesting place and kind of more. It's enticing.
Well, he does say hateful and bad down here,
but it's something that's necessary. So.
But we forget that being in the light and on the two good side can also be hateful and bad.
Yeah.
And because it cuts us off from a lot of our humanness.
Right, because he follows this, like, are you again indignant about the hateful and bad? He's saying it is. There, it is there. That is part of it. And without knowing that, you can't reach your own divinity. Or that's how I read it.
Yeah. I would say, you know, to put it in ordinary language, failure, rage, hatred, confusion, mistakes are all necessary ingredients capable of guiding us to who we are. That's what we don't natively grasp. because everything is geared against failing, you know, against bad feeling, against frustration. As soon as we get into that, we think we're lost, and in fact, that may be just the directing experience we need.
It also seems like hell is experiential, so, you know, the bad is something that you can't really explain even after you're out of it, but the good is something that we somehow can give language to.
I don't know if we can't give language to hell. It sure is a lot more difficult.
Well, I thought it was interesting because when he says no one knows what happened during the 3 days Christ was in hell, I have experienced it. It's not like he's saying I was, you know, I am God in hell, but it's inexplicable. But I know what it feels like, mm-hmm. and he doesn't go on to try and explain it, but figure
right.
it out. But
right.
I know it, what it's like.
There's one sentence that is popping into my mind that somebody told me. I never really read this. So something about the emphasis, saying that you have to hold and love the idiot in yourself, hold it out of the way.
Same idea.
Mm-hmm.
One of my teachers said, don't ever repress your stupidity. And it's amazing how often you'll be in a situation and everyone's talking like it's a great thing and you're thinking, this is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. And if you would say so, you'd look stupid because they get it and you don't. But if you do say that, it's interesting what happens. Often it shows up, they have no idea what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Or they think it's stupid too, but they didn't feel like they had the freedom to say it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or you learn something important about how you misunderstand things.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one time on World Hunger Saver, and it was back in our show, it was on depression. And there were people calling from all over the world and that, and it was so fascinating because they over and over again talked about how difficult it was to language it.
Mm-hmm.
And because we don't give it much room in our culture,
mm-hmm.
and it's not something that people talk about. So, I mean, people from all over the world were talking about this. They were talking about William Styron's Darkness Invisible, how people try to give it imagery, and that's about the best you can do is to give it image. But it's one of those things like beauty. You know it when you see it. You know it when you're in it. And it was fascinating listening to people from Uganda and Europe and all over talking about depression and the difficulty to give it words.
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what it was, his voice. Anything else there?
Just that it ends with a certain
really bright people like the new leaders, like the Winston Churchill.
Probably some others, but I can't think of that. He called his person the black dog. And really,
charismatic people also answer souls.
Yeah. I didn't know they call it his black dog, huh?
He called the black dog easier. Abraham Lincoln, too.
Yeah, in fact, there's that book. Have you seen the book that says he became who he was because he lived through his depressions?
Mm-hmm.
I forget what it's called. But
I haven't read the book, but I've heard that.
Yeah, because we always try to get rid of him.
And he had, this is totally off topic, but Abraham Lincoln had this series of dreams where he saw the coffin of the president, and it was very disturbing to him, and he would stand outside one of the big rooms, and he'd say, why are you all crying? And they would say, the president is dead, and then he would wake up, but he was never allowed to go into the room, and then just a couple of nights before he died, he was allowed to go into the room, and he allowed himself, which I thought was really
cool.
Yeah.
You know, that footnote number 135 talks a whole lot more about references to that whole descending to hell than what 38 that Jung noted.
It doesn't give any biblical reference, though, does it?
Apostles' Creed. Yeah.
Other than the Apostles' Creed.
Well, let's see. Gospel of St. Peter, in which Christ gives a detailed description of hell. Jung's copy of this work has numerous markings in the margin. And in the rear are two additional papers.
Yeah, but it's an apocalyptic fragment.
Not
canonical.
Mm-hmm. But I like what it says there, the 3 days descending to hell at the very bottom. During death describes the sinking of the vanished value into the unconscious, whereby conquering the power of darkness, it establishes a new order and then rises up to heaven again. That is, it attains supreme clarity of consciousness. That's what talks about conquering. That's instead of.
Julie, when we're talking the death of the hero, we're talking the death of the outer hero, but the hero's journey that comes by, you still have all of the relations to your own as a world as state. I think that's confusing to me. Would you not say that, like, the making of your own, some of those, I'm thinking of, like, the Joseph Campbell.
Yeah, exactly. But see, I think Jung is saying all that stuff's old. Who mentioned Concord? You mentioned Concord. Did you?
Yes.
Yeah, see, that's hero language. And later, you don't get that anymore. It's two opposites affecting each other.
Yeah, this is 38.
Later. Two opposites in alchemy, it's two opposites affecting each other. In Job, it's the standing ego that elicits a change in God. In Gnosticism, the self is constructed. He lets go of that conquering imagery after the hero myth. Volume 5 is about the hero myth.
Would that be like the Grail legend?
Still hero. We think about that. I have to go back and really examine that.
I'm wondering if, like, maybe it is somewhat different for women since that book was written by Emma Young and like Maria Louise Fontaine's, if maybe there is some value in the hero myth for women, particularly if they are not, if their feeling function, their intuition,
yeah,
more of that kind of a strength. Maybe I'm not sure where I'm going with this.
Remember, we talked about this earlier on, and this idea of what the heroic is. And
right.
Heroic is dependent upon what it is that you're being called to play that isn't serving you. So remember, we were talking how paradoxical the idea of the hero can be? Because in traditional mythology, the hero is the one that rose up and slayed the goddess. And at that point in time, the linear progression began. Versus the idea of the cyclical nature of life. Now we look at this linear. So then all this heroic mythology came out of that. And those ancient images of the goddess, the serpent, and all of those became that which had to be slayed. But we now have to take on a certain amount of heroic stance against the Western cultural image of the hero. In other words, we have to be able to stand in the face of that and allow it to stir the soul and the spirit of the self. So it's heroic, but it's not heroic as the Western mythology would have us think of that. Remember what we talked about?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So the heroic stance is necessary, but you've got to be careful how you use the word heroic. Because that conjures up what you've been talking about, Gary, the whole idea of power and hierarchy. And that's not the hero that we're talking about.
Well, we've talked about how when you're young, I mean, to a certain period of your life, that hero...
Right, it's important for a while.
Critical.
Yeah.
To have, I mean, when you're in that early phase of your life, to be able to
right.
do that, you have to somehow, and if you don't, there's a lot...
I think you say the reason we have the hero myth is because there are so few heroes around. It's
when we talk about killing Siegfried, I see that as a different. The hero he's killing is that aggressiveness and that will to power that in himself.
Yeah, I think that the traditional hero is always will to power.
Yeah.
That's
even
the
at
difference.
A young age, you're saying.
Yeah. That. And that's necessary at a young age. This is midlife.
Mm-hmm. Well, like Job, I mean, his stance was entirely different. Or, you know, you even think of Gandhi. I mean, that's strength.
Right. It's a different kind of strength.
It's still strength. It's not will to power over domineering somebody else,
mm-hmm.
but it's standing with your internal strength to against a value that you don't. So it's, I guess you could call it heroic, but it's more of a, to me, it's more strength that is not domineering.
It's not domineering.
And it doesn't violate the opposite, but yet it stands against it.
If I had to give it a phrase, it would be the strength of yin versus the strength of yang. And we don't normally think yin has a strength.
Those of us who are yang. But those of us who are yin understand that.
Yeah.
That's the
Dorothea Height that we've just all been talking about is an example.
What's that?
Is it Dorothea Height? Is that her name? That they've been talking about the civil rights woman in the
80s? Yeah.
And, I mean, he called her heroic. And yet, you know, hers was an aggression that was just a standing on principles and insisting on action that served her people.
Or Rosa Parks.
Rosa Parks. And the movement, anybody that stands for, you know, homosexual rights, and any time you face the cultural principle that doesn't serve.
Yeah.
I don't know if I read it in Jung or where I read it, but he talked about the ego being strengthened in early life, and then in midlife on, it opens up. And is able to not be full of itself, but to open up to what really needs to happen in one's life at that time. And I'm not saying right, but
no, that answers it.
I think that it has to do with the place that I'm at and my own confusion about. So it actually is helpful.
And that, you know, that talks about our inner strength that we don't even know we have sometimes. You know, until we're up against the wall, and then there it is.
The image I keep in mind are those, I've showed them years ago, I'm sure you don't remember, but there are two scenes on the signet rings that the Minoans and Mycenaeans have. And, of course, the earliest is the Minoan, which is prior to the Indo-Europeans coming. Yeah. And it's the depiction of what's thought to be the worship of Adonis. And on one side of the ring, a man is tearing down a tree. On the other side of the ring, he's kneeling and a bird is descending. And it's thought... it's the destruction of the goddess in one phase and the reappearance or the rebirth of the goddess in another phase. The Mycenaeans made the same ring. The difference is, in the Minoan ring, when the bird is descending, the man is on his knees. And in the Mycenaean ring, which is patriarchal, he's standing. See what I mean? The hero, at the deepest sense, tears and is torn. The patriarchal hero tears, end of story. I think that's how I understand the difference. And this word that you pointed out is conquering. He's conquering the darkness, but what Jung is going to say later, and he's conquered by it. He forgets to put that extra little clause in there. That's the difference between a patriarchal and a non-patriarchal ego.
You said before, at another class, you said the hero doesn't ask whether killing is necessary. It just kills it, and midlife, it feels to me like sometimes you allow it to die, and you stay with it while it's dying.
Mm-hmm. And then you die, too.
Because of your helplessness.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that sometimes it's harder to allow something to die than it is to kill it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you can't kill it. It has to die of its own volition. You can't kill it. In my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
You could think you kill it, but you really don't. You're still there.
But I think that our world is moving toward that. You know, don't deal with the pain. It's like,
right.
You know, put the animal out of its misery.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not debating whether or not you should do that for an animal that's suffering, but that process of, say, watching grandma die for weeks and weeks and weeks is much harder than saying, you know what, stop feeding her, which we're moving toward because it's so painful.
Mm-hmm.
And it really makes you, you know, to live in that space while the dying is happening, so difficult.
Did anyone see the Jack Kevorkian thing that Al Pacino did?
Oh,
that would be a good museum.
What's the name of that?
It's a movie?
You don't know Jack.
You don't know Jack. It's very good. It's very well done. I was amazed how well done it was. So. But he's out of jail now, which I didn't realize.
So is that a documentary or is it in there?
No, it's a drama.
I mean, it's
in the theaters or on TV?
It's on TV.
On
HBO.
But you know, both of those are difficult. The moving to that place of watching someone or making that other decision, you know. I think that's what we're grappling with in our culture is that. And are we playing God? You know, but in my mind, our medical profession is playing God equally so by putting people on machines. I don't think easy.
But I'm using that really as a metaphor for the killing of the hero, or, you know, the hero being the conqueror.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes conquering means just letting go, but it's very uncertain. The letting go is uncertain because if you kill it, it's done. And you know how long it's going to take, and you wash your hands and you're done, regardless of what fallout you may have to deal with. But if you let it die, you've got this whole process, and it can take an indefinite amount of time, and the blood's not on your hands, but it's seeping into your pores, and you know, so you're sitting with something that's uncomfortable for much longer. It's a different kind of heroism to me.
Well, in any case, however we conceive of it, this is the shift that I think Jung is seeing in his text culturally, that we haven't even allowed the possibility of the non-heroic hero. And what he was a hero. He was a psychoanalytic hero. He was living in a very posh house. He had sort of made it And he realized he had to give that all up. Personally, and looked around and saw there was no models for that in the collective. So he's not just working on himself, he's trying to give us an understanding of how many of us may need to change if we really want to do something creative. Okay, 244.
Can I ask one more
question? Yes.
When you are going through the change and you see, you know, he said, I have to change, I have to give all of this up, mm-hmm. and there are other people affected, like, you know, like his children or his family, how does that play in? Because doesn't that change their story too?
I think he felt terribly guilty. You know, that story, I saw it in the last couple of years, an interview with his daughter, his last surviving daughter, I think, and she said, when we moved to Kuznacht, the mothers had a meeting whether we could play with their kids. Because he was a kook psychiatrist. Well, I'm sure that tore him up, but it didn't stop him. But he realized his guilt was he realized he was guilty because he was affecting the lives of other people. I feel sure of that.
Like you said, he wanted
to commit suicide.
And during this time, he slept with a gun, right, nearby.
I think that was because of his Burkholz-Lee. The danger of working in the Burkholz-Lee. But still, he could have used it on himself. Oh, well, the next 244, I think it's more of the same. If you want, maybe you can pick up particular sentences. First column, the difference between the depths and the heights. Third line there, the depths are this ambiguous understanding of living. And the heights are the clear, success-oriented, dominant understanding of living. And to things that he brings up, the importance of fear. You know, not always being dynamic and fearless. Only the heroes say they are fearless.
Very
inferior. 244, the left-hand column, the second paragraph, go up two lines from the bottom of the second paragraph. Only the heroes say that they are fearless. See where?
Okay, thank you.
But you know what happens to the hero. Interesting detail, don't go into the depths alone.
What's he mean?
You know, I think it's in analytic work, that's why you're talking to somebody. And it's important to have a relationship. Otherwise, you just become cold.
And you become psychotic.
Or psychotic.
So depressed that you can't get yourself out.
Right, so depressed you can't get yourself out. Or cynical, or... that first, second, third... Again, this is nothing new. He's just circling around that idea. He who journeys to hell also becomes hell. One, two, three, four paragraphs. Next paragraph, what if the depths due to the assault now change themselves into death? But the depths indeed have changed themselves into death. Therefore, when they awoke, they inflicted a thousandfold death. That if you, the again, I think kind of what Nancy was saying, the real hero dies, is capable of death. Where the patriarchal hero dominates. Uh, You might say that this hero achieves his success by virtue of a rapport with death. Death as a companion versus the patriarchal dominates death, overcomes death, conquers death. Hmm? Well, yeah, for a while anyway.
It also says down there in the footnote that it's a reference to the Chronicles of World War I.
Yeah. Yes, let's talk about that. So, I think what he felt he was going through was a presaging of the death of World War I. And as he saw his death as necessary for his change, he felt the catastrophe of World War I and World War II was necessary for the rebirth of something societally. So he's building a bridge between his own despair and war, and a bridge between what he is learning in his despair and what he thinks is meant to be learned through war.
Do you think that's an interesting statement right off the bat? We cannot slay death, as we have already taken all life from us. If we still want to overcome death, then we must imbibe it.
A lot of weird statements here.
Mm-hmm. I just said, no?
Yeah, I think, in other words, if you look at it from the point of view of the war, don't shy away from asking about the meaning of this war. And I don't think it's hard to understand if you take it personally. But I think the big distinction here is that one's natural tendency at catastrophe is to say, "Oh God, how do we prevent this from happening?" And he's saying the way to prevent it from happening is asking, "Why did it have to happen?" We had to have those wars. Now maybe we can have the wars inside ourselves.
Oh, good.
Because we're still in this death and rebirth process that this announces.
So to enliven death would mean to have the war inside you and that one.
Well, I'd say to ask the meaning of it. Why do these wars occur?
What I thought of there was when you're asking, like, as a little game or whatever, to write what you would want on your tombstone or to think what it is you want to be remembered about. a way of bringing the fact that you do have a finite life into making your choices really matter. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, that would be one of the personal lessons of death. I'd say that to enliven it means to learn from it. Instead of just saying, oh, it's horrible, let's get away from it to say, what do we need to see it's got to teach us? So in a funny, morbid way, it gives it value. I was reading recently somebody's account of their work with Jung, and apparently they were right in the middle of a psychosis, and Jung said to him, look, this is your last great chance. That's another way of putting it, I think. Not, oh, what DSM-4 category do we label you under? But how is this tragedy in your life a chance to make a change like no other? Might be another way to put it. I tell you about the, I don't know whether what I did was right or not, but there was a woman I met here 20-some years ago, had worked with Jung, and she was in very bad health. She was in her, about 85. And she had all the pictures she painted under his care in her room. She's living with her daughter down in Greenwood. And all my colleagues said, oh, get those pictures and publish them. Maybe I should have. I didn't. I didn't feel like I should intrude. But she said, I said, how did Jung work with you? She said, well, I went to him with eczema, completely, you know, cracked, oozing eczema. And he said, your hands want to speak. Got her painting. And she painted herself out of her eczema.
Wow.
That would be another example where the death, you could have slapped medicine on it and got rid of it, but he let it speak. His paintings are probably sitting in a basement somewhere in Greenwood, but it just didn't feel right to go nosing into her psyche yet. Late 80s, she was, I think. Sometimes I regret not having done it. Well, I guess it's about the middle of the first column on 244. Might be time for a stretch.